This is BOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. An airline employee in the U.S. city of Seattle, Washington, stole a plane, flew it, and performed stunts before crashing it into an island late Friday. Paul Pastor is the local sheriff.
There was no indication that he did this to threaten anybody. There's no indication of any kind of terrorist link or anything like that. Apparently, he was in contact with the tower while he was flying the airplane.
The plane was owned by Horizon Air, an affiliate of Alaska Airlines. The Seattle-Tacoma International Airport was briefly shut down as the incident unfolded. The Saudi-led coalition in Yemen says it will investigate the airstrike that hit a bus full of school children, but the UN wants an independent investigation. Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda.
The airstrike hit a bus carrying the kids as it went through a market on Thursday. The Houthi faction, which controls the area, says an additional 11 adults were killed in the attack, bringing the total to at least 51 dead. Saudi coalition says it will investigate, which is an apparent change in tone. They originally said it was a legitimate military action against their Houthi enemies, who they alleged were using children as human shields. The UN is calling for an independent investigation, which was praised by the Houthis, although the UN's also criticized that side for indiscriminate attacks of their own. On Friday, the UN said its human rights coordinator for the war also appears to have been blocked from returning to Houthi territory without explanation.
Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda. The Trump administration is doubling steel tariffs on Turkey. This starts Monday. That news caused the Turkish currency to hit its worst one-day loss in a decade. Ties between the countries have been strained as Washington is urging Ankara to release Andrew Brunson. He is an American pastor currently detained on terrorism charges in Turkey. More at BOANews.com. This is BOA News. A free speech group says that U.S. President Donald Trump continues to block dozens of people from his Twitter account, although a court ruled his actions violate the First Amendment. The First Amendment Institute at Columbia University in New York sent a letter to the Justice Department saying Trump is still blocking 41 people from his @RealDonaldTrump account. The group contends almost all of the people were blocked after they posted unfavorable tweets about Mr. Trump or his policies. A mother and daughter deported to El Salvador from the U.S. this week flew back to the United States hours after a federal judge ordered their return and threatened to hold top officials in contempt in the U.S. if they failed to comply with the order. The two are among a dozen victims of gang and domestic violence in Central America who are fighting deportation from the U.S. after their asylum applications were rejected in recent weeks. President Trump took to Twitter praising Mexico and also threatening Canada. The tweets referenced efforts to renegotiate the terms of the North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA. The tone of his comments about Mexico was friendly, considering previous comments about Mexico and accusing Mexican immigrants of being criminals and a different tact with Canada. Mr. Trump tweeted about their tariffs and what he called trade barriers, which he said are too high. Canada responded saying they are protecting Canadian interest. A newspaper in the U.S. city of Boston is calling on other newspapers around the country to respond to President Trump's frequent attacks on the news media. AP's Tim McGuire has more.
The Boston Globe is asking newspapers across the U.S. to publish editorials next Thursday, the 16th, denouncing what it calls a dirty war against the free press. The Globe asks other papers to take the stand regardless of their politics and whether they generally are for or against the president's policies. President Trump often characterizes the media as fake news and journalists as his true political opponents. I'm Tim McGuire.
A jury in the U.S. state of California has ordered agribusiness giant Monsanto to pay $289 million to a school groundskeeper dying of cancer, saying the company should have provided a label warning that its weed killer could cause cancer. Monsanto denies this. Wildfires in the U.S. state of California continue to rage as one blaze in the southern part of the state has come within mere meters of residential areas and destroyed more than 7,000 hectares of national forest land. California Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency in Orange and Riverside County. Those are near where Forrest Clark has been arrested and charged with arson in connection with the fires. I'm Tommy McNeil, BOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
These are charges that trumped up against us try and silence opposition in this country and to cause them to fear so that they may not stand up against the dictatorship that we've been fighting all these years.
Ugandan opposition leader says his party will not be deterred in the fight for citizens' rights.
It comes all from both sides. I won't blame the PR team solely. I would also blame the advisors. When I look at the president, he lacks the reaction character. He can't react properly. So the moment maybe the PR team talks to him, and I doubt that the PR team tells him the truth.
A Malawian columnist says the president's communications advisors are failing to do their jobs.
No, right now there are more than 400,000 Burundian refugees in the Great Lakes region, and all these people fled the persecution by the security forces and the ruling CNDD-FDD militia in Bonirakure.
And Burundian civil society groups call on Tanzania to stop the repatriation of refugees. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The leader of the Ugandan Main Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, Patrick Amuriat, says the group's leadership will not be intimidated by threats to arrest them. His comments came after local media reported that the government plans to issue criminal summons to the FDC leader and colleague for refusing to go to court to answer charges against them. The charges include inciting violence, holding unlawful meeting, and assaulting police officers. For reacting to plans to issue criminal summons against him, I reached FDC leader Patrick Amuriat in Arua, northern Uganda.
Well, I am really not bothered about any summons given by police. These are criminal summons for us to appear in court. Dr. Kizza basically appeared in court last time together with other leaders of the party, and because we really do not believe in the court process, my colleague and I decided to stay away from court. And I do not believe in this court process because, first of all, the merits of the case itself is a political case. These are charges that are trumped up against us to try and silence opposition in this country and to cause them to fear so that they may not stand up against the dictatorship that we've been fighting all these years.
But Patrick, if you said this is all trumped up, then aren't you giving the so-called people who are trumping up the charges against you the ammunition to come against you by flouting the law for you to appear in court to defend yourself against what you allege to be trumped up charges?
Well, we choose to defy this because, first of all, when we've been to court before, this must be taken into consideration. But even whenever we went to court, the prosecutor either wasn't there, the magistrate wasn't there, or, you know, the witnesses were not there. This is really meant to drain energy from us, and I feel that they are not being fair. What I need to also be understood is it takes away a lot of time from us, time that would otherwise have been used to mobilize the population in the country and to ensure that we speedily cause a change in this country.
One of the charges against you was assaulting police officers. Why would you do that? Or why would you encourage members of the FDC, the main opposition party in Uganda, to attack the police? I mean, these are people mandated by the constitution to enforce the law, to protect life and property. Why do you attack them?
One needs really to understand the situation in which we are in this country. There is no way a policeman would be assaulted by leaders. The case that is under discussion at the moment happened in Mbarara in Western Uganda, where we came under police siege. You know, hundreds of policemen came, surrounded us. We kept in our cars. How then could it have been possible for us to assault a police officer? We were actually almost powerless because we were left alone under their mask.
Now, other charges that you face with some leading members of the FDC include inciting violence, holding unlawful meetings, and malicious damage to property. I remember when this happened in 2017, and police blamed the FDC leadership for orchestrating this, for causing public disaffection and increasing tension, which could plunge the country into chaos.
That cannot be believed by anybody, because for us, we have always advocated for nonviolence, and that is what we stand by. If we were a violent group of people, then we could have opted to other means of bringing change to this country other than just merely talking and mobilizing the people of this country. So I would like to dismiss that allegation with the contempt that it deserves. But, you know, that doesn't bother us. We will do this. We know that this is what we should expect in a struggle like this. And, I mean, we've faced even more and more humiliating and cruel treatment in this country. But this is not going to dampen our spirit. We will keep going, and we believe that one day we'll free our country.
Patrick Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition FDC. He spoke with me from Arua, northern Uganda. A Malawian columnist says President Arthur Peter Mutharika's communication team has failed to do its job. In a newspaper column published Saturday, Albert Shara wrote that the communication team has made the president to look weak and ineffective to resolve challenges his administration faces. His remarks came as critics also say the rest of the president's advisers have failed. This, as Vice President Saulos Chilima accuses the government of corruption. The vice president quit the ruling party and has launched an opposition group to challenge the president in next year's presidential election. For more on the Saturday column, I reach Albert Shara in the commercial capital, Blantyre.
President Mutharika is a different president, like if you compare with the president that we have had all these years. He's a man who is so quiet, and he has got his own leadership style. But now if you are to analyze all the scandals that have happened since he came into power, you would see that there is a major failure by the PR. Because the moment you have got a president who doesn't speak or who doesn't think fast, who is slow in reaction, you rely on the PR team so that they are out there and then they are able to paint a positive picture about you. Now, everything that has been happening in this ruling party has been unfolding slowly. And we already know. Actually, if I was one of the spokesperson of the president or the advisors or among those in the PR, I would have known that this issue that has come out, it will take the president maybe 3 or 4 months to react. Then I, as a PR builder or an image builder, I would have thought about what should I do? Because if I wait for the president to react late, then it would mean that time would be too late maybe to change the story.
Some people are saying that the buck stops with the president. If he has to react to something that he feels strongly about, he would urge his communication advisors to go ahead. So they said some of the arguments you're making that they are making him look bad is neither here nor there. How do you react to that?
Yeah, but still my argument is it comes all from both sides. I won't blame the PR team solely. I would also blame the advisors. When I look at the president, he lacks the reaction character. He can't react properly. So the moment maybe the PR team talks to him, and I doubt that the PR team tells him the truth. That's my fear. From the way things look, the PR team always promises him positive things instead of telling him the truth so that maybe he can react. So if there's one of the members in the PR team really tells the president the truth, I would have seen the president maybe saying something differently. 2 days ago, he was on the state broadcaster defending some of the issues. The way he spoke, he was someone who is a stranger. Actually, I was even shocked to say, really, the president has come out and talked to the people this way. Does he know actually how much damage is on the ground? So actually, it's a complete fail from the advisors, the PR, and the president himself. But now I'm blaming the PR team and the advisors, because they're not telling him the truth. Have they told him the gravity of the situation on the ground? I hope that the president would have come out with a strategy that maybe would have changed the perspective on the ground. And secondly, the president has got a problem. He's not taking the media seriously. So the problem in Malawi at the moment is that both the advisors and the PR team, they are protecting their job. So they are lying to the president that we are managing the situation on the ground. Don't be afraid. Everything is in control.
Some are saying that this is just a pile-on. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
Actually, they're justified and very true. And the problem of hiring advisors based on political affiliation, that's where everything comes in. If a good president has to hire advisors who are experts, if you're hiring someone to advise you on social issues or on youth issues, you need to have someone who understands those issues, someone who will not be driven by political affiliation or political interest. The problem at the moment is that the whole party and the people who came into government with Mutariza are the people who are interested with DPP, who are connected to DPP, the party that he runs. So whatever they are doing for their interest, they are protecting their job. So the moment you go to tell the president, because in Malawi the situation is that the president is most feared. Even if I'm an advisor today, I'll be afraid to tell him the truth, and maybe he might fire me to say, no, you're not performing.
Some are suggesting that if things continue to go like it is now, the president stands a chance of losing his re-election bid. Is this accurate?
Actually, there are two folds to that. Yes, actually, this issue, especially the recent issue that is the food scandal that was done by the Malawi Police Service, in which the president is being accused of pocketing part of the money. That is the biggest scandal, because that is outright corruption. And his vice president, who has now formed a parallel structure, is also using that one as a major argument or justification to say, yes, I've been saying there's corruption in this government, and yes, it is happening. So yes, the chances are that Mutharika stands a chance of losing more votes. That is what even what I've read in my column. So he stands to lose more votes, especially those people who have been loyal to him. You can really lose the votes. But the problem at the moment is that there's now a division. This new movement, which is now is promising more, he has created a division now. The main opposition party is now breaking slowly. And all those three other parties that were hot contenders, they're also breaking away. Now the problem would be, if Mutharika doesn't sort these things now, before maybe end of this year, then you struggle. If he wins, that you struggle.
Albert Shara is a Malawian newspaper columnist. He spoke with me from Blantyre. Burundian civil society groups are calling on Tanzania not to repatriate refugees to Burundi. The groups say Burundi is not safe despite assurances from the government in Bujumbura. The groups plan to protest at the embassies of Tanzania in Europe and the United States in a move to pressure the Tanzanian government to stop the repatriation of Burundi refugees. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza says the country is safe and called on Burundian refugees to return home. For more regarding the call by the civil society groups, I reached Vital Nshimirimana, the Burundian leader of the group Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society.
Yes, we have committed to demonstrate before the Tanzanian embassies in Europe and the US and Canada because these are free countries that are respectful of freedoms, and we wanted to tell Tanzania that it is mistreating Burundian refugees, forcing them to return in Burundi while Burundi remains in a crisis.
But why are you saying they are being forced to go to Burundi when your government in Bujumbura is saying emphatically that the situation has returned to normal and that there's no violence and that it is peaceful? Why wouldn't they go home?
No, right now there are more than 400,000 Burundian refugees in the Great Lakes region, and all these people fled the persecution by the security forces and the ruling CNDD-FDD militia in Bonirakure, and the persecution continues. And right now there is ongoing inter-Burundian dialogue, which have not even really started, and which is facilitated by the former president Mkapa. And because of this unsolved crisis, we cannot say Burundi is at peace.
Well, the Tanzanian government, through its minister, denied the mistreatment of Burundian refugees and that some of these refugees that you are speaking about went back home on their own accord. They were not pressured, they were not forced to go. And that some of these accusations Burundian civil society groups in the diaspora are making are frivolous and unfounded.
Well, all started when President Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi visited Tanzania. And in 3 years, it is the only visit outside the country that Pierre Nkurunziza made. And he told President Magufuli of Tanzania that the situation is normal. And now we have reported hundreds of arrests in Tanzania of Burundian refugees. Some have even been killed in Tanzania. And in 2 weeks ago, the Tanzanian authorities decided the closure of small businesses within the camp to make life more difficult for refugees. This is an awful, illegal, and harmful pressure to refugees to force bring them to return.
But you have instances where Burundian refugees in Tanzania have caused violence, they have attacked each other, making, you know, life unbearable for residents in the neighborhood where they are being camped. Do you blame some Tanzanian citizens when they are defending themselves and putting pressure on the government to ensure law and order in the camps?
Well, because Tanzania security forces do not provide enough protection to refugees, they allow infiltration by the Burundian security intelligence forces and the militia in Bonerakure that infiltrate refugee camps to cause violence and crimes so that they can say that they are refugees who are committing some crimes. Some in Bonerakure have been identified. It is not even only in Tanzania. Even in other neighboring countries, these infiltrations have been reported several times.
The Imbonerakure militiamen you spoke about, the government has denied them as working for the government. And have you registered this protest to the UNHCR, the body under the United Nations that handle refugees?
Well, the Imbonerakure is presented as the youth affiliated to the ruling CNDD-FDD party. The government of Burundi does not agree that Imbonerakure constitutes a militia. And it enjoys a political and administrative support from the top officials in the government, including President Nkurunziza, because right now we have parallel command of security forces. So these Imbonerakure are the one perpetrating crimes, threatening security, and expanding terror in Burundi and in the region.
Vital Nshimirimana is the Burundian leader of the Group Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He spoke with me from Belgium's capital, Brussels. The South Sudanese government and opposition groups have begun the process of implementing the peace agreement signed last week, but some analysts warn it will be difficult to maintain the bloated government for 3 years. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
South Sudanese leaders will have a three-year transitional period to put the country on a path toward peace and resettle its people, both those who fled the country and those internally displaced. During the transition period, the country will be run by a government that includes 5 vice presidents, 35 cabinet ministers, and 550 legislators. Deo Gumba is a researcher with the Institute for Security Studies. He says countries and international organizations will find it difficult to fund and maintain such a bloated government.
It will require a lot of support from donors international partners to ensure that this bloated government works. The transition period of 3 years is quite a long time. They usually say that politics, one day is a long time in politics, and therefore 3 years for a transition will be a very long time indeed. To be able to do things that would change the situation quickly, because the longer it stays, the more things are likely to remain the same.
James Okuk, a political science lecturer at the University of Juba, sees the transition going longer than 3 years.
If a lot of things are not put in place, it could be extended for a few months, especially if the election preparation need some more time. They could extend it even to 4 years. So it's not a big deal, because a lot has been destroyed in South Sudan, and you need a real transitional period where you can put things back to order.
As part of implementing the peace agreement, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir on Thursday granted amnesty to rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition leaders. Some regional observers have welcomed the renewed effort to end South Sudan's civil war, but Okuk says a lot needs to be done to change people's behavior in solving their differences.
The mentality that has developed during this time of conflict, that mentality has created a culture of war, culture of violence. So there's a lot of work to be done, really, to reset that mentality of the people, so that they really adopt the culture of peace, and then they can resort to the rule of law in case of any differences or any difficulties.
South Sudan has been mired in civil war since December 2013. The United Nations says the war has driven more than 4 million people from their homes, with more than 2 million people living as refugees in nearby countries. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Zimbabwean main opposition party has filed a legal challenge to the July 30 presidential election result. The challenge puts a hold on the swearing-in of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, which was scheduled for Sunday. For VOA, Colombo's Mahunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Just before the close of business Friday, Movement for Democratic Change Alliance lawyers arrived at the Constitutional Court with legal papers challenging the declared victory of President Emmerson Mnangagwa in the July 30 election. The opposition says the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission rigged the election for Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF party. Lawyer Thabani Mpofu is confident of having the election results declared invalid and of the opposition candidate Nelson Chamisa being declared the next president.
And on the basis of the evidence that we've placed before the court, we seek in the main relief to the effect that the court must declare the proper winner, and that proper winner is my client. In the alternative, we seek that there be another election which complies with the dictates of the law, which complies with the letter and spirit of the Constitution of Zimbabwe. And as regards the inauguration, there is no inauguration that's going to take place. Up until the matter has been resolved by the court, that is the position.
ZANU-PF and the Electoral Commission have 3 days to respond to the lawsuit, and the case is now expected to be heard by the full bench of the Constitutional Court within 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Tendai Biti, an opposition leader who early this week fled to Zambia seeking asylum, was in court this Friday challenging his deportation from Zambia and his subsequent arrest by Zimbabwean officials. Biti told the court he feared for his life after security forces opened fire on protesters outside the Electoral Commission on August 1st, 2 days after the election.
I've had my house bombed on 2 occasions, but nothing I've gone through in the last 7 days or so compares to what has happened in the past. It's unprecedented, the levels of attack, the nature of the threat. And I've never felt so threatened in my life.
Beat is one of the several senior opposition officials who police said they were looking for earlier this week in connection with alleged election-related offenses. Beat is facing charges of public violence and announcing false election results. He is denying both charges. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent.
Makume, oh, Makume.
Well, you heard it here on Nightline Africa. He's a prominent Ghanaian musician who performs all around the world. His fans call him Mr. Music Man, among others. Kojo Inchi joins us live here in the Viewer Studios in Washington, D.C. Good afternoon, Kojo.
Good afternoon, Pete.
So what are you doing here in the DMV?
Hey, you know, the music brings me here. I'm in the States, touring, I think, about five different states. I've done Chicago already. Tonight I'm doing D.C., next week it will be New York, then Atlanta, then Worcester, ended up all in Dallas.
All right. Now, we just played this new song. I've never heard it before till today. Okay. What is the title of it?
Atitiakuma.
What does that mean?
Heartbreaker.
Lord have mercy. So what made you come up with such a song?
Well, you see, I see a lot of our African brothers and sisters on the Sahara. Mm-hmm. Trying to get to greener pastures. Some kind of carrot has been dangled in front of us. So we think we can find that greener pastures on that blessed continent that we were created on. So we look for that in somewhere else, only to find that that well is so empty, unwelcome. So it's you can relate to a whole lot of things, but that's for me as a songwriter, as a wordsmith, that's what I mean. But it talks about the heartbreaks, running to a well, to you. I mean, you are thirsty, you go to the well looking for water to quench your thirst, only to find that it's been dead dry for a long time.
All right, now, so tell me. This is your new song?
It's a new song.
Or a new album?
A new album, which is about to be released.
When?
Soon.
All right. Soon. Now, so talk to me about the expectations of Ghanaians or your fans who will be coming to watch you this evening.
Chicago was great.
I heard that over 1,000 people came.
Sure.
All right.
And for me, Chicago was more of a rehearsal.
Okay.
The main show starts tonight. And we've been doing this for decades now. I feel very comfortable on stage. The last year, the last time I was here is about 6 years ago, but in DC, 8 years ago. So I'm really looking forward to tonight's show. And for me, the stage is set for a good show because the hall is good, the ambience, the sound and everything. I mean, yesterday we had sound check and the stage is prepared for a great show.
So you're talking about music that you started way back. Will they be hearing everything from when Kojo started hitting the airwaves in Ghana till now?
I will be in Chicago. I was on stage for about 4 hours. Maybe I may do more than that, depending on the atmosphere.
The vibe you get from the people.
Say that again.
All right.
Yeah, the vibes.
So talk to me about Ghanaian music.
Yeah.
Some people have said that it appears not to be going anywhere. It's only enjoyed by Ghanaians. It's not even cutting across the West Africa sub-region, let alone dominate the continent like some other countries are doing, and not doing quite well on the international arena. Talk to me about it. You've been in the industry for so long.
I would dispute that.
Okay.
Because you have Ghanaian music being played all over the Francophone countries. You go to Liberia, and an artist like Ohima Mercy is a giant. Even though her songs are gospel, it is played in the nightclubs in other states because in other countries because they don't even know that she's singing about the Lord Jesus Christ. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And then you find young guys like Stone Boy headlining reggae events in Germany. We do have BET nominations every year since the past 8 years that a category was created for international artists. I was the first to appear on the, I was first nominated mm-hmm. when that category was created. Mm-hmm. My worry is not just the Ghanaian music. I speak as an African.
Right.
And I think Africa has churned out a lot of great militant musicians like Fela, Hugh Masekela, who just passed away some few months ago, mm-hmm. Mariam Makeba, who used their platform, they used that medium to fight apartheid. Mm-hmm. Now I find a lot of great African musicians who are not singing about our issues, but they are singing about self. Baby, do that for me. Baby, shake that thing for me. And I think that is where my worry is. But I think African music is doing great. You go to Europe, you go out of Africa, and Afrobeat is all over the place. Quite recently, I know a Nigerian artist who performed in Suriname. He was amazed, shocked by the crowd who went there to listen to him. So as I said, I speak as an African. African music is doing well, but we're losing out on that message. The message to build the African continent is what we're losing out on.
Well, you travel quite a bit. You meet some of these up-and-coming musicians. What do you tell them about this message you're talking about, the message to change what is going on that they feel will not help the society, improving the lives of people, so they will hold their leaders accountable, so their leaders will do right by them? Yeah. How do you tell them?
Well, I use platforms like this. I use platforms like this to address these issues. I am, in my own little way, putting up an incubation center to start dealing with some of these issues. You see, the social media, internet has granted all of us a lot of opportunities, and it seems a lot of these things cannot be controlled, because even when you speak against some lyrics or images that you think are not too good for the public to consume, you still find them, because everybody is a publisher, everybody has some space. It started with MySpace,
right.
You know, so they have a way of bringing it out there, whether you speak against it or not. But I think somehow we will have balance. But the duty is not just on us as musicians. It is on the vibrant liberation of the airwaves that we find all over Africa.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, you tell us exactly where you are going to perform in Washington, D.C. this evening.
Yes, man. My love, told you to go, Pour some sweetness on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sugar on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sugar on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sweetness on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sugar on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sugar on it, pour some sugar. Pour some sugar, pour some sugar.
Man is right here, Mr. Music Man, as his fans affectionately call him. So let me ask you, Kojo, this evening you are performing in Northeast Washington, D.C.
Correct.
Which place are you performing?
Karma Music Center. I think you can find that on 2221 Adams Place. That's NEDC 218. The door opens at 9, precisely.
Good, yeah. Good. So before we went on that short break, you were talking about African music and its impact.
Yes.
Do you see the potency of African music increasing or decreasing in the next few years to come?
I believe it will increase. I mean,
What makes you so optimistic?
I have to be. There is so much talent. We have so much rhythms. I mean, I think the music and our rhythms are untapped. And I mean, I'll say that when Africa, the continent was colonized, the rhythms were not. You know, even though someone is pushing that 4-4 beat, that disco beat, there is more to African music than just that 1-2-3-4. We have the 6-8, the Agbaja, the Osode, Adowa, the Nagla, and all that. They are untapped.
Now, I remember you had collaborations in the 80s and the 90s.
I'm still having them.
Well, all right. Now, so how do you strengthen African music with collaboration from countries all over the continent? Like you have the East Africans joining West Africans,
yeah.
West Africans to Congolese music, sure, Rumba, and sure, the rest sure. to make it richer.
I collaborated with a South African songstress called Santi Ndambele. Mm-hmm. Or Minyan Taban and a few other songs. I've done collabos with a Nigerian artist. I see Africa coming together. We hear Africa unity, Africa unity. We are practicing it on the stages. I mean, a man called Ajovi started this Kora Awards. It was like Africans doing it for self. We always linking up, show Africa in different ways because that is our voice. You know, we have to tell our own story. And but the problem we are facing is that music now is sold digitally by downloads. Unfortunately, I'll speak for Ghana. We have a lot of people using credit cards, but the confidence of going out there to buy music on the net is not well placed because you don't have a lot of people with iPads. Of course, we have all the phones and that, you know. Music is being used mainly on the telcos platforms. And so the young ones are benefiting from that. But the older generation are suffering from this because the CD sales used to be, here is your CD, I take my money. So we are slowly evolving into grasping what is happening to the music industry.
Before we take another break, some people have expressed concern that there's no unity among Ghanaian musicians back home, and that there are several groups and the lack of unity prevents
the Ghanaian musicians from coming together to pressure the government to implement policies to benefit the work, the hard work you put into making the music.
Yeah.
What is the solution, and how do you think these can be rectified, some of these concerns?
I don't buy into that. And I think we should look at music, what it does to a society. Those conflicts, you will find them in every society or in different endeavors. I mean, you find them. What music does to the African society is, for us, music is not a product. Music is a tool. It's a weapon. Because, like I said before, we are the ones that doesn't have a voice. Every time there is Ebola, AIDS, they always say Africa. They will point to us. So what are we using, the little platforms that we have to, you know? If you start talking about the disunity amongst Ghanaian musicians, it is because we've been rated as the last on the list. You understand what I'm saying? I've been blessed to have tasted the best part of this music since early 80s to now. We have all the different venues you could perform and make a living out of your music. Right now, like I said before, you don't sell CDs. And if you put two hungry dogs into a cage, they'll start fighting each other. So that is not no reason. I think we are trying to structure our copyright association, which is GAMRO. There is Musica, which is a union. I believe we don't have enough. We want to lobby that even mobile phones and iPads are included in what royalties are collected on the recordable items that are used. I mean, you see, so the battle is uniting us has become difficult because the avenues to get returns for our works are difficult to find.
We'll be right back for your last message before we go. Well, Kojo, before we leave, what is your final message to the people of Ghana, and particularly to your listeners and lovers and your people who will be coming to see you tonight?
Oh, my message will be simple. It will be to thank them for supporting our music. I'm not talking about just my music, but the African music as a whole. I expect all of them to come in and support my show tonight. I hear Amachi Dede is also he's also around gigging. Bisakede is also around gigging. They should all come out and support us. From here, I go to New York. Like I said, Atlanta, Worcester, and Dallas. To the people, people of Ghana and Ghanaians living in the States, I will tell them Africa is the next greatest thing. They should all get involved and let's build this continent called Africa, because we've been blessed. Let no one tell you otherwise.
Thank you. That was Kojo Entry. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ethiopia has been suffering the effects of a devastating series of droughts, which began 3 years ago when the El Niño weather pattern caused higher temperatures in this country of 100 million people. While an above-average rainy season this year is expected to help improve agriculture in parts of the country, the damage done by several consecutive failed rainy seasons has been significant, resulting in widespread crop failures and devastating loss of livestock, and leading to successive humanitarian disasters. Further compounding the situation is a large-scale displacement of approximately 1 million people since April in the West Guji and Gedeo zones of the Oromia region and Southern Nations Nationalities and Peoples region, respectively. This newly displaced population is in addition to the 1.6 million Ethiopians already pushed from their homes by conflict or drought. With large-scale displacement occurring along the border of the Oromia and Somali regions, who need immediate vital humanitarian assistance. Today, as a result of these conditions, nearly 8 million are facing hunger, particularly in Oromia and southern Somali regions. In late July, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced an additional $170 million in humanitarian assistance to support the people of the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia. This new funding brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution for Ethiopia to more than $802 million since October 2016. The funds will go toward emergency food and nutrition assistance, life-saving medical care, shelter, and safe drinking water, as well as programs to improve sanitation and hygiene programs to stop the spread of preventable diseases. This assistance will provide vital humanitarian aid to millions of Ethiopians trying to recover from the shock suffered since 2016, as well as to refugees who are seeking shelter in Ethiopia. This assistance will meet the immediate needs of those displaced, keeping them healthy so that they can return home safely and voluntarily, resume productive lives, and participate in the process of addressing the root causes of conflict, said USAID Mission Director to Ethiopia, Leslie Reed. The United States urges additional contributions from the government of Ethiopia and for the community of nations to meet the needs of vulnerable Ethiopians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.